Alrighty, Shabbat Shalom, and welcome to those who are listening to the Bible study with us today. As I said last week, we started a new study here on the book of Revelation, and it will take us quite a bit to go through it. We're not going to rush. That's the great part with Bible studies. You can just start and go wherever you want to go with them, and then when the time is up, we wait till next week to pick up where we left off, just like last week. Last week, we got through the first six verses of chapter one of the book of Revelation. We will continue with that today. And like I said, we'll just go through it week by week until the book is finished. But wow, as I was saying last week, what a great Bible study to do now. As Yahweh is restoring all things, and the book of Revelation, that's a closed book. We see in the book of Isaiah, it says about, you know, and I gave the book to him, and he said, I can't read it because I don't understand books. And here we are at the very end of time, right? Not only the last generation, but the very end of the last generation, as we're seeing so many things in so many scriptures, a lot of them not good about the end time, like in 2 Timothy 3, but we're living it. We're seeing it with our eyes. And I think that's the only consolation in this really wicked world, is that it was prophesied to happen this way. And as we see these evil things going on in the world, it just shows us how much closer we are to the kingdom. But just a great time to be doing this Bible study, because the words are jumping off the pages. And it's so exciting every day to get up and open up your Bible and study your Bible, because it's a living book, and we're living in that very last days. And very soon, you know, you're going to go to bed tonight, and then the next night, and day will go into week, and week into month, and month into year. But very shortly, one of these times, you're going to wake up, if you're blessed to be alive at that time, and our Messiah, Yeshua's feet are going to be right on that Mount of Olives, and his kingdom will be here. So what a good time that we're living in. So we stopped in verse 6, and Yahweh made us kings and priests to Yahweh, and he made us kings and priests to Yahweh, even his Father. To him is the glory and the might forever and ever. Amen. And we went over that. I'm not going to go over that again. And now verse 7. Behold, he, Yeshua, comes with the clouds, and every eye will see him, and the ones who pierced him, and all the tribes of the earth will wail on account of him. Yes, our main. Wow. So, he's coming in the clouds, and every eye will see him, and the ones who pierced him, and all the tribes of the earth will wail on account of him. Yes, our main. And it's very interesting, because most likely, we can't say this 100%, but it seems to be most likely, probably 90%, Yeshua will return on what we call the Feast of Trumpets, or in the Hebrew, Yom Teruah. And in the Hebrew, it's a little bit different, because teruah can mean the blowing of a trumpet. But literally, Yom Teruah is the feast of clamoring. You know, it's the feast of clanging. It's like, I forget where it was. It might have been in Argentina or one of those places a couple of years ago where they had a real bad financial situation. And all the people, I think the banks closed down and people lost their money. And the people came to the streets and they were clanging pots. And they're showing it on the news, and you see everybody out there clanging their pots. And when that's happening, when you hear noise like that, clamoring and clanging, it could be in a good way or a bad way. You don't know. You know, it's a lot of noise. And for the ones who were the first fruits, who are waiting for Yeshua to come, the Feast of Trumpets or the Feast of Yom Teruah, that is, it's a good clamoring. It's an excitement is here, and it's like clapping and yes and praising and Father. But to the ones who are not looking for him to come, it's a bad clamoring. It's a upsetment. You know, it's a people all not wanting him to be here because they know that his kingdom is here, and they know that they will not be in that kingdom. So that's why it says, and all the tribes of the earth will wail on account of him. Because except for the first fruits, the true believers, these other people do not want him to come back. Let's go to Daniel 7, verse 13. Daniel 7, verse 13. And it says, and I was looking in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of the heavens, and he came to the Ancient of Days. So while we see the Ancient of Days being Yahweh, and one like the Son of Man, who was Yeshua, again, even in the book of Daniel here, you see very, very clearly two separate beings, the Father and the Son not being the same being. We went over that last week. I'm not going to go over that again. But like it says here in Daniel, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of the heavens, right? And that's exactly what we're seeing here. Behold, he comes with the clouds, and every eye will see him. And the ones who pierced him, right? The ones who pierced him. What's he talking about? Zechariah 12 in verse 10. Zechariah 12 in verse 10. Says, and I will pour on the house of David and on those living in Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of prayers. And they shall look on me whom they have pierced. This is the Messiah speaking. And they shall mourn for him as one mourns for an only son. And they shall be bitter over him like the bitterness over the firstborn. So this is Zechariah. The book of Zechariah is all about in the end time, right? If you just go back a couple of verses back here, you see verse 2, behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling for all the people and all around it, and it shall also be against Judah and the siege against Jerusalem. And in that day I will make Jerusalem a heavy stone for all the people. All who lift it will be cut in pieces, and the nations of the earth will be gathered against it. And here we see, right, just not a few weeks ago, a month ago, whatever it was, when President Trump announced that Jerusalem is the eternal capital of Israel, and America would be moving their embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, and all the uproar that this has caused in the Arab world and around the world. And the United Nations called a special assembly meeting on this, and they voted something like 178-6. Mostly every nation on earth voted against Jerusalem being the capital of Israel, just like it's saying here. And in that day will make Jerusalem a heavy stone for all the people, and all who lift it will be cut to pieces, and all the nations of the earth will be gathered against it. Wow. And yet I was telling the story last week when I went to Papua New Guinea, when we were there, that the Prime Minister of Papua New Guinea decided to change their vote and vote for Jerusalem. So while Yahweh's Spirit was there before us, preparing for the hearts of the people in Papua New Guinea to accept the restoration ministry from Jerusalem, and praise Yahweh that they did that, but we see that here. So this is definitely end time, and now we get to verse 10, and I will pour in the house of David, you know, the Jewish people, and on those living in Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of prayers, and they will look on me whom they have pierced. When Yeshua comes back and they see the holes in his wrist and the holes in his side, right? Then, and in his feet, then they will mourn. They'll realize, wow, Yeshua was the Messiah. And they'll mourn and they'll cry, because it's not that Jewish people are against Yeshua for the sake of being against Yeshua. The problem is, like every other false religion on the earth, that they've been taught for many, many hundreds and even almost 2,000 years from their rabbis and their teachers, not to even look at the New Testament, that the New Testament is anti-Semitic, that you know, all these bad things about Yeshua that are written in the Talmud and the Mishnah. And at the end of the day, many people have never looked at it. But I've talked to people in Israel, Jews, that even some that were Orthodox that have come to faith in Yeshua. And some of the testimonies that they gave were, wow, you know, even though the rabbis, I mean, would religiously tell us, don't ever open a New Testament, don't ever look at it. The ones who did open it up and look, they said, wow, this isn't anti-Semitic. This is all Jewish. This is all about Jewish. And everything that the rabbis have taught us about the Messiah is written about Yeshua in the New Testament. So how great that is. But this is what it's talking about here in the book of Revelation when it says, and the ones who pierced him, you know, behold, he comes in the clouds and everyone will see him. And the ones who pierced him, talking about this from Zechariah 12 and verse 10. And they shall look on me whom they've pierced, and they shall mourn for him, and they mourn for an only son. So praise Yahweh that even though The eyes of our brother Judah may be blinded now. The time is coming where their eyes will be open and they will be accepting Yeshua as the Messiah. If we also go to Matthew 24, verse 30 and 31. Matthew 24, and verse 30 and 31. It says, "And then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the heavens, and then all the tribes of the land will wail, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and much glory. And he will send his cherubs with a great sound of a large trumpet." That's why we said it's Yom Teruah. Most likely that this is going to happen. 1 Corinthians 15 tells us at the last trumpet, you know, the trumpet will blow, and then the Messiah will come back. And they, the cherubs, will gather his chosen ones from the four winds, from one end of the sky to the other end of the sky. So here we see that exactly what it's saying in Revelation. "Behold, he comes in the clouds, and every eye will see him, and the ones who pierced him, and all the tribes of the earth will wail on account of him." Yes, amen. So when Yeshua comes, we see that everyone will see him as he comes. And our brother Judah, like I said, will understand what they did wrong, and they will cry with cries of repentance and accept him as Messiah. Many of the nations or the people around the earth, most of them will not want him. They will fight against him. And most people at that point are going to die, as we see in the book of Revelation, people's eyeballs melting in their socket, and Yeshua coming to destroy every enemy that he has. But then from that point, the kingdom will be coming. And we will be as his first fruits and his ambassadors, right? Like it says, we will be kings and priests. Just like on this trip that I was here, and also when I was in Liberia last year, they rolled out the red carpet. That red carpet is put down, and you walk on the red carpet as the ambassador of Yahweh, as a dignitary. And each of us at that time, we will be going to the nations. Yeshua will be sending us to the nations, and we will be helping them to rebuild their lives. We will teach them about the Torah, and we'll teach them about proper education and proper organic growing and healthy living and worship, true worship of Yeshua and Yahweh. And wow, what a time that is going to be if you're looking forward to it. If you're not, like I said, the Feast of Trumpets, the Yom Teruah, the Day of Clamoring, if you're not looking forward to that, it's going to be wailing and weeping of teeth. But if you're looking forward to it, it's going to be happy and just joyful singing and praising and screaming. Okay, verse 8. "I am the Aleph and the Tav, the beginning and the ending, says Adonai Yahweh, the one who is and who was and who is coming, the Almighty." Okay, so here we see Yeshua saying he's the Aleph and the Tav. The Aleph is the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet. It comes, Hebrew started out as a pictograph language, and the Aleph was actually a picture of an ox. It means strength of family. And the last letter of the alphabet is the Tav, which is like a cross. You know, that's the letter Tav. It's the last letter of the alphabet, meaning covenant. It's very interesting. So he's saying he's the beginning and the ending. We went over this last week that he has no beginning and no ending, Yeshua. He's eternal, says Adonai Yahweh, the one who is and who was and who is coming, the Almighty. So again, we see, did Yeshua preexist? Of course, it says it here, who is and who was and who is coming, and he'll always be there. Revelation 21, 6, Revelation 21 and verse 6. "And he said to me, it is done. I am the Aleph and the Tav, the beginning and the ending. To the one thirsting, I will freely give of the fountain of the water of life." Right? "To the one overcoming will inherit all things, and I will be Elohim to him, and he will be the son to me. So he said to me, it is done." Talking about Yeshua, "I am the Aleph and the Tav, the beginning and the ending." So we see that, very interesting. If you look in the Bible, the very first word in the Bible is Bereshit, which means in the beginning. So in the beginning, this whole Bible from Genesis to Revelation is the story of mankind's fall, Yahweh's creation, mankind's fall, and Yahweh's redemption. So he's the beginning and the end in that there's no beginning of mankind without Yeshua. He created all things, like it says in Colossians 1, all things were created for him and by him and through him. So he was always there. He is the creator of everything with the Father, of course. The Father gave the command and he went and he did it. And he is the end of everything. You know, that in the end, there is no life without end. Everything continues, but it all is through Yeshua that's there. So I am the Aleph and the Tav, the beginning and the ending, who says Adonai Yahweh, the one who was and who is and who is coming, the Almighty. Revelation 22:11. Go to another scripture there. Revelation 22:11. The one acting unjustly will continue to act unjustly, and he who is filthy will continue to be filthy, and the righteous will continue to be righteousness, to do righteousness. And he who is holy, let him continue to be holy. So again, showing the continuity. When the kingdom comes, everything is a constant, and people will get what they'll continue to do. The evil will be rewarded with the lake of fire, and the righteous will be rewarded with eternal life. Let's go down to verse 9 now. I, even your brother John, and co-share in the affliction and in the kingdom and patience of Yeshua Messiah, came to be in the island being called Patmos because of the word of Elohim and because of the witness of Yeshua Messiah. So, we talked about it last week a little bit. I'm not going to really rehash it again about, we see here there's a John who's writing this. It's never been 100% stated who this John is. I went over there could be most of the possibilities people believe. Today, I would say the vast majority of people believe this is the Apostle John who wrote this. But actually, in early times, in the 2nd, 3rd, 4th century, most people believe that it was John the Presbyter. He's another John that is 2nd century, or rather late 1st century, 2nd century disciple. And many people think that he's the one who wrote Revelation. And I gave a third theory, possibly it could be John the Baptist. If you didn't hear the beginning, the first part of chapter 1, please go back and listen to it on the website www.cohyhwh.com in the audio section. But I'm not going to rehash my reasons for that now. But once again, we see definitely it's a John. Whichever John this is, it's John. And we see something else. He's on the island of Patmos. So that's another clue here, right? There are some writings by some of the Christian church fathers that say the Apostle John did go to the island of Patmos. Whether that's true or not, whether they're writing it after the fact, we don't know. But there are writings, some writings that say that. We don't know really if he was there or not, but he could have been. The same as there's nothing I've ever seen written that John the Baptist was ever in Patmos, but he could have been. Because we know that John was in a wilderness somewhere until the time of his showing. That's what it tells us in the book of John about John the Baptist. So where was that wilderness? Who knows? Nobody. We don't know for sure. You know, there's theories on it, but we don't know. But Patmos is a Greek island in the Mediterranean. And like I said, some writings say that the Apostle John was banished there by one of the Roman emperors. They're not sure if it was Domitian or Claudius or Nero. The fact that they don't even know which emperor it was shows you that you can't put too much stock in if John, the Apostle John, really was there. Because, again, it's being written after the fact, so different accounts are being written. But as far as the island goes, it's a very interesting island. One I've never been to, but one I would like to someday maybe see. It's a very barren place. Producing very little grain, but abounding in partridges, quails, turtles, pigeons, snipes, and rabbits. It has many good harbors, and periodically through history, also it's been a place where pirates have gone a lot and pilfered it because of the, I guess, the easy area, the good harbors in the easy area that a lot of pirates have gone there through the time. But that's all we really know about Patmos. Nothing was ever found there, as far as I know, of a book of Revelation or a scroll of Revelation or anything like that. I know that traditionally they do have a monastery there from the Greek Orthodox and caves where they say John wrote the Revelation in this cave. which is mostly tradition, but who knows? But like I said, we do know he's there, and because of the witness of Yeshua Messiah, you know, and he's being witnessed because of the word of Elohim, because of the witness of Yeshua Messiah. Verse 10, I came to be in the Spirit on the day of Yahweh, and I heard behind me a great voice as a trumpet. So we know that most Bibles and most Christians, if you look in a Christian Bible, like a King James Bible, right? This verse, let me get it up here, says, I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day, and I heard behind me a great voice as of a trumpet. So, again, I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day, but literally it should be, I came to be in the Spirit on the day of Yahweh. You know, the day of Yahweh, the day of Elohim. And so many Christian pastors will use this verse because they really don't have any other verses to try to prove that Sunday is the day of worship in the New Testament, that somehow the Sabbath by Yeshua suffering and being humiliated and beaten and dying on the torture stake or the tree of crucifixion, that somehow that changed Saturday, the Sabbath, to another day. You know, I don't know how that would, one would have to do with the other, but that's what they say. And they use this verse. They're saying, well, the fact that he came to be in the Spirit, and even if it was, I came to be in the Spirit on the Lord's day, right? If that was the translation on the day of Adonai or Adonai's day, it never says that that's the first day of the week. It never says that that's a Sunday. But if we're honest with ourselves, because we know that Yeshua called himself Lord or Master of the Sabbath, right? He didn't call him Lord or Master of the first day of the week. So if there's any day that he's the Lord of or the Master of, it would be Sabbath, because that's what he says in his word. So as Sabbath keepers, we can very easily go to this verse and try to prove that the Sabbath is still, Saturday is still the Sabbath, because he's the Lord of the Sabbath. And here it says they're in the Spirit on the Lord's day. But we would be not being totally honest if we did that, because it's not talking about a day of the week. The book of Revelation, I said this last week, it's like watching a film. You're in real time. John is in a vision, and he's seeing something that's 2,000 years off, and he's seeing it as it's happening in our time, and most of this hasn't happened yet. So things that most of the things that haven't even happened that are written here, John is seeing it because he's seeing a vision. He's not actually seeing what he's seeing. He's seeing a vision of what it'll be in our day. And that's why when he's looking at maybe helicopters and these different things, you know, and military helicopters and plane, and he's saying they look like locusts or grasshoppers, you know, and they really do in a certain way, because he never saw an airplane or a military helicopter or any of that stuff. But he's seeing it on the day of Yahweh. So what is the day of Yahweh? The day of Yahweh is Yahweh's wrath on mankind. Let's go to scriptures and show this. Let's go to Joel 2. Joel, the second chapter. It says, blow a ram's horn in Zion, Mount Zion, and shout an alarm in my holy mountain. Let all those living in the land tremble, for the day of Yahweh approaches. It is near. The day of Yahweh is a time frame. It's not one day. We don't know how long the day of Yahweh is. It could be, my guess is it's probably a year, because Yahweh says in Numbers 14:34, where Yahweh says a day is as a year and a year for a day. So we see that sometimes, that a day is represented as a year and a year for a day. And that's why I said, as 40 days you were wandering when the spies went out for 40 days into the land of Israel, for 40 years that you will wander in the wilderness. So the day of Yahweh very well could be one whole year. And he does cut that time short, so it could even be shorter than that. Most likely won't be longer than that, but we don't know for sure. But it's a time frame that the day of Yahweh, for the day of Yahweh approaches, the time of his wrath, that's what it is. It is near. It is a day of darkness and gloominess, a day of clouds and thick darkness as the dawn spreads out the mountains, a great and strong people. There has never been the like, nor shall there ever be again to the years of generation to generation. A fire devours before it and a flame behind it. The land is the Garden of Eden before them, and behind them is a desolate wilderness. Yea, also there is no escape for them. Their appearance is like horses, and as war horses, so they run. They shall leap like the noise of chariots on the top of mountains, like the noise of flames of fire that devour the chaff, as a strong people set in order for battle, right? This is a spiritual battle going on. Before their face the people shall be pained, all faces collect heat. They shall run as mighty ones, they shall go up the wall as men of war, and they shall each go on his way, and they shall not change their paths. And every man does not press his brother, they each go in his own paths, and if they fall behind their weapon, they shall not be cut off. They shall rush on the city, they shall run on the wall, they shall climb up on the houses, they shall enter in by the windows like a thief. The earth will quake before them, the heavens will shake, the sun and the moon will grow dark, and the stars will gather in their light. And Yahweh shall give his voice before his army, for his camp is very great. For he who does his word is strong, for the day of Yahweh is very great and fearful. Who can endure it? And you're right. Wow. Because as we're going to see in the book of Revelation, as these things go on, we see that basically the seals, when they're taken off, and we have the seals of Revelation wind up going over a fourth of the earth, and then we have the next step that goes on a third of the earth, and then Yahweh's wrath goes on all the earth. So this is a time where at the end of this, very few people are going to be left. Very, very few people. Let's also go to Isaiah 13 and verse 6 to see the day of Yahweh, the wrath of Yahweh. Like I said, not a particular day, but his wrath. And Isaiah 13 is about what else? About the destruction of Babylon. The burden of Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amos saw. And verse 6 says, howl, for the day of Yahweh is at hand. It shall come as a destruction from the Almighty. On account of this, all hands will droop, and every heart of man shall melt, and they shall be afraid. Pains and sorrows shall take hold of them. They shall be in pain like one giving birth. They shall be amazed, each man to his neighbor. Faces of flame shall be their faces. Behold, the day of Yahweh comes, cruel and with wrath, fierce anger, to lay the land waste, or the earth actually, and he shall destroy its sinners out of it. For the stars of the heavens and their constellations will not give their light, like we read in Joel. The sun will be darkened in its going forth, and the moon will not reflect its light. So we know there's going to be cosmic events that are happening here, right? And I will visit evil on the world and their iniquity on the wicked, and I will cause the arrogance of the proud to cease, and I will humble the pride of tyrants. And I will make a man more rare than fine gold, even a man more than the carvings of Ophir. So we see at the end of this, right? Very few people are going to be left on this earth. I say maybe 1 or 2%. That means 98% or so of the people living on this earth today will be dead. But even 1 or 2% are still millions when you consider 8 billion people in the world. You know, you're still looking at tens of millions of people that will be here, but it's nothing compared to how many people on the earth today. And verse 13. So I will shake the heavens, and the earth shall move out of its place, and the wrath of Yahweh of hosts, and in the day of his fierce anger. Wow. So, again, we're looking at, I came to be in the spirit on the day of Yahweh, on the day of Yahweh's wrath. And I heard behind me a great voice as a trumpet, right? We said when Yeshua returns, we read it in the other verse in Matthew 24, there's a sound of a great trumpet at the last trump, like it says in 1 Corinthians 15. The trumpet will sound and the cherubs will come and we will shed these earthly bodies and we'll meet Yeshua in the air and forever be with him. I heard behind me a great voice as of a trumpet saying, what you see, write in a scroll and send to the seven congregations of Asia, to Ephesus, to Smyrna, to Pergamos, to Thyatira, to Sardis, and to Philadelphia, and Laodicea. So, like we said, we have here seven congregations. I went over this a little bit last week. We'll go over it in detail in the weeks to come as we hit each congregation and the meaning to each congregation. I've done many messages on it. It's all in my book, The Gates of Hell Shall Not Prevail Against Her. So, I mean, I'll go over it limited to a degree, but still we will go over the message of each congregation because, like I said, these seven congregations were 7 historical eras in the congregation. I clearly go over that in my book, The Gates of Hell Will Not Prevail Against Her. But they were also 7 congregations in the end time. There's 7 congregations or 7 spirits or attitudes of today. And the message I did a while ago, a message from Yeshua to you, which I highly suggest to listen to if you haven't, there's a message in one of these congregations to each of us. If not, you're in trouble. That means you're not part of Yeshua's congregation. But can you imagine that he wrote these letters almost 2,000 years ago? The Holy Spirit inspired him to John to write them in the scroll of Revelation. It is a scroll. And like I said, for 2,000 years, people could read it and they can get something from it. But those messages are for us today. They're for the ones who are living today because those spirits are here. And unfortunately, the greatest spirit that's here in the congregation today is the Laodicean spirit. Now, when I say the congregation, I'm not necessarily saying congregation of Yahweh Jerusalem, but in the different branches of Yahweh's congregations. Because the Laodicean spirit is far and wide, and it's just everywhere, you know, that rich and increased with goods in need of nothing, and yet they're poor, they're blind, they're miserable, naked. And this is why Yeshua is trying to get people to come out of it. But also we see like the Seventh-day Adventists, as we'll get into, the Thyatira spirit is alive and well within that congregation, as well as to Sardis and Pergamos and the other ones. So as we get into them next week and the weeks after that, we'll go over each one in detail, but fairly brief. I'm not going to take a Bible study on each congregation. I don't think I will. We'll see when we get there. But I don't think I will. I think I'll go over them probably in a couple of studies that we'll get over all 7 of them. We'll see. But these are who the 7 congregations are. They're those 7 congregations that are around today. And it was an actual mail route. These 7 congregations, you could look on a map online and you can see. They were located in Asia Minor, which is modern-day Turkey. And it was literally a mail route that went there. And in verse 12, and I turned to see the voice which spoke with me. So now this John is there, and he's being spoke to by a cherub, and he's turning around to see. And having turned, I saw 7 golden menorahs. And in the midst of the 7 menorahs, one like the Son of Man, wearing a garment down to the feet, and having his breast girded with a golden girdle. Wow. So we see that Yeshua is wearing a garment down to his feet and his breasts having been girded with a golden girdle. And there were 7 golden menorahs, and in the midst of the 7 menorahs. So we know that the menorah in ancient times was the symbol of ancient Israel. And we know even today, some people think that the Magen David, the actually pagan star that's on the Israeli flag, is the modern symbol of Israel. Is not. It is simply the symbol that's on the flag. It was put there by Lord Rothschild, who gave a lot of money for Israel to become a nation. He was a 33rd degree Mason, one of the architects of the end time right now New World Order. And he was the one that wanted to put the hexagram, the 6-pointed star, on the flag. And Ben-Gurion agreed to it because of the help that he was giving. But it is not the modern symbol of Israel. If you look on any official paper coming from the Knesset, the government, anything, it all has the menorah. The menorah is still the symbol of Israel. And as we see here, it's the symbol of the new covenant, the Brit Hadashah. It is the symbol of believers today because it's the symbol of the congregations. I saw 7 golden menorahs for the 7 congregations. So every congregation is symbolized by the menorah. That is the symbol that Yahweh put for ancient times, and it's the symbol that he gives today. Now, what about this about, though, Yeshua having a garment down to his feet? Exodus 20 and verse 26 is very interesting. Because when we're looking at modesty, and we say we don't want to be self-righteous, we want to be Yahweh righteous, and we want his righteousness to be our righteousness. And so, what is modest? You know, what is modest? There's people that I've seen, women at times, that have skirts only down to their knees, and they think that's modest. Because most women have skirts that are way higher than that. But is really a skirt to the knee, is that really modest in Yahweh's eyes? Well, in Exodus 20 and verse 26, and this is talking about, you know, all the building of the tabernacle and all this stuff, and the priests coming up for the altar. He talks about in verse 24, you shall make an altar of earth for me, and all this. And if you make an altar of stone for me, you shall not build them of cut stones. When you swing your tool on it, you defile it. So it has to be unhewn stones, like we see in Mount Ebal. And verse 26, and you shall not go up by steps to my altar, that your nakedness may not be uncovered on it. So you shall not go up by steps to my altar, that your nakedness may not be uncovered on it. So, in Yahweh's eyes, that's why there was a ramp for the priest to go up, that if the priest was walking up a step, bending his leg to walk on a step, and showed his ankle, Yahweh calls that nakedness. So again, that's not Don's words, that's Yahweh's words. So when you're looking at modesty, you know, we should be fully clothed, you know. We should be clothed. You shouldn't be wearing clothes that are tight, showing your body parts. You shouldn't have, you know, men and women should be wearing, women should be wearing long skirts or dresses. Men should be wearing long pants. And it's that simple, you know, that we should be modestly. This is the example that Yeshua is giving us here. He's wearing a garment down to his feet and having his breasts girded with a golden girdle. Genesis 37:3, chapter 37, verse 3, talks about the coat that Jacob or Israel made for his son Joseph. And it says, and Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons because he was a son of his old age. And he made a coat of many colors reaching to the feet. And literally, when they say coat of many colors, it's literally the word is really the word is used for hand. And what they believe is that it had almost like a quilt. It had many little squares on it. And if you had many squares, they probably think the squares were different colors. But it was reaching to his feet. It's reaching to his feet. So this is the same as we see here from Yeshua, a garment down to the feet and having his breast girded with a golden girdle. Verse 14, and the hairs of his head were white as wool, as snow, and his eyes as a flame of fire, and his feet like burnished brass, having been fired in a furnace, and his voice is the sound of many waters. So, wow. So, this is not the human Yeshua. This is the glorified Yeshua that's coming back with hairs on his head were white as wool, as snow, and his eyes as a flame of fire, and his feet as burnished brass, having been fired in a furnace, and his voice as the sound of many waters. Go to Daniel 10, 5 and 6. We see similar here. Daniel, the 10th chapter, verse 5 and 6. Then I lifted up my eyes and looked, and behold, a certain man was clothed in linen, whose loins were wrapped in fine gold from Upaz. His body was also like the beryl, and his face looked like lightning. And his eyes were like torches of fire, and his arms and his feet in color like polished bronze or brass. And the sound of his voice was the noise of a multitude, right? So here it is. This is Yeshua, the Son of Man, like he says in here, appearing to Yeshua in the book of Daniel. How amazing that we see this looking the same way. Ezekiel 1:26-28. And from above the expanse that was over their heads was an appearance like a stone of lapis sapphire, and the likeness of a throne. And the likeness of the throne was like the appearance like a man on from above, on it from above. And I saw him like the color of polished bronze, looking like fire within it all around, from the appearance of his loins and upward, and from the appearance of his loins and downward. And I saw him looking like fire and brightness all around it. And as the appearance of the bow that is in the cloud in the day of the rain, so appeared the brightness all around. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of Yahweh. And I saw and I fell on my face, and I heard a voice of one speaking. So we see that when Yeshua is returning, he's returning as the glory of Yahweh. Wow. And that's why he's coming with a white garment. That's why he's so bright, that unless you're one of his, unless you have his righteousness, you won't be able to look at him and survive. The same way today, you couldn't look at the sun. you know, and survive. It's so bright, it would burn your eyes out. And that's exactly what's going to happen, that when Yeshua returns as the Son of Righteousness, not the sun in the sky, but His brightness is so much, and His glory, of the glory of the Father, is in Him, that anybody who is not a true believer will not be able to stand it, to be able to look at Him, or they won't survive, like it says in Revelation 14, 1 through 4. As He comes on the Mount of Olives, and His eyeballs will melt in their sockets. Verse 16, and having in His right hand seven stars, and a sharp two-edged sword proceeding out of His mouth, and His face shining as the sun in all its power. So, if you go to verse 20 here, the mystery of the seven stars which you saw on my right, and the seven golden menorahs. The seven stars are the messengers of the seven congregations, and the seven menorahs you saw are the seven congregations, just like we read here a couple verses before this in verse 13. So the menorahs represent the congregations, and these stars are cherubs. Every congregation has a special messenger to that congregation, a cherub, and that's what he has there. Now, when we're looking in the book of Revelation, Revelation is a book with a lot of symbolism and, you know, it's just the way the book is written. Hyperbole, symbolism, these are all things that are in Revelation throughout. So, when you get to chapter 5, or chapter 6, I'm sorry, you know, there's a scripture there, and many times, you know, people can send in questions on the website, and many times we get the question from chapter 6, well, if the dead are asleep, then why in Revelation 6, in verse 9, does it say, and He opened up the fifth seal, and I saw under the souls, under the altar, the souls of those having been slain for the word of Yahweh and for the witness which they had. And they cried with a great voice, saying, until when, holy and true Master Yahweh, do you not judge and take vengeance on our blood from those dwelling on the earth? And they say, well, you know, the question, well, if the dead are in the grave waiting for the resurrection, then why are they here doing this? And people don't understand, like I said, the book of Revelation is written in hyperbole and in symbolism. The whole book is written in that. So do you really honestly think, if you want to take it at face value, do you really think, because like I said before, number one, we're reading something that hasn't even happened yet. So even if this was exactly like it's saying it is, then these people aren't under that altar right now because it hasn't happened yet. They haven't been killed yet. You know, and a lot of them are still alive, or maybe, you know, who knows? But the point of it is, this is something that hasn't happened yet. So clearly Revelation 6:9 is not a proof that the dead are not asleep and in the grave when you're looking at the symbolism in Revelation. The other thing is like I said, do you really think that all these people, like think about it, think of an altar and all these people crammed under the altar next to each other, you know, bending down. Do you really think that that would be the way it would be? No, it's symbolism. Yahweh's trying to make a point of symbolism because the altar is the altar of sacrifice. That's where sacrifice is made. And these people were martyrs. So it's symbolically saying, you know, that symbolically that these people are praying and saying, you know, Yahweh, you know, how long will it be, you know, like before our blood is avenged. So it's symbolic. It's a symbolic thing, but it's not to be taken literal. The same way when we look at chapter 4, chapter 4 of Genesis, right? When Cain kills Abel. And you go down to verse 11. Or verse 10, I'm sorry. And Yahweh says, what have you done to Cain? The voice of the blood of your brother cries to me from the ground. So do you really think that Abel's blood is crying from the ground? No, it's symbolism. It's actually the Hebrew language is filled with this. That's the way the Hebrew language is. And that's why Aramaic, which is very similar, Yeshua, most of his parables written in this form of hyperbole, the way that he uses symbolism. Kol v'komer is another form of the symbolism that's used, and that's what he's using here. But as we get over here in verse 16, look what it says, "And having in his right hand seven stars and a sharp two-edged sword proceeding out of his mouth." So do you really think when Yeshua comes that his mouth is going to be wide and there'll be a sword coming out of both sides of his mouth? Of course not. It's a phrase. It's a symbolic phrase. It's a euphemism, right? That's used here. A phrase. A two-edged sword coming out of his mouth. Meaningly, that, like we said, the Feast of Trumpets, Yom Teruah, the Feast of Clamoring, that it's a two-edged sword. Why? Because for the ones who are waiting for him, they're going to be happy and they're excited. For the ones who aren't, they're miserable and crying and wailing and gnashing of teeth. So this is why it's saying that. But just that you realize as we go through the book, don't think every single thing is literal. A lot of it is literal, but not everything is like this. This two-edged sword proceeding. And how do you know the difference? Usually you could tell. It's pretty simple if you just logically think about it, that Yeshua would not have a two-edged sword hanging out of his mouth. "And when I saw him, I fell at his feet as dead. And he put his right hand on me, saying to me, 'Do not fear, I am the first and the last.'" You know, like we see again, the Aleph and the Tav, the beginning and the end, the first and last letter of the alphabet. But very interesting, when you look at this verse, "And when I saw him, I fell dead at his feet, and he put his right hand on me, saying to me, 'Do not fear, I am the first and the last.'" If we go to the book of Daniel, chapter 10, and verse 5, Daniel 10 and verse 5, we see something very similar. "And then I lifted up my eyes and looked, and behold, a certain man was clothed in linen, whose loins were wrapped in fine gold." So we just read this, so we know this is Yeshua, right? Definitely. But look what happens in the book of Daniel. Go down to verse 12. "And he," the man, "says to him," Yeshua, says to Daniel, "'Do not fear, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand and to humble yourself before your Elohim, your words were heard, and I have come because of your words.'" So, when we see Daniel, go to verse 9 now, "Yet I heard the sound of his words, and when I heard the sound of his words, then I was on my face stunned, and my face was toward the ground. And behold, a hand touched me and set me shaking on my knees in the palms of my hand. And he said, 'O Daniel, O greatly beloved, understand the words they speak to you and stand up. For I am now sent to you, and when you have spoken this to me," Aleph Tav is in there, "the word, I stood trembling." So we see very similar, the same thing. "And when I saw him," verse 17 of Revelation 1, "I fell at his feet as dead, and he put his right hand on me, saying to me, 'Do not fear, I am the first and the last.'" So what Yeshua did to John here, Revelation 1, is almost exactly what Yeshua did to Daniel. And these, again, are little symbols, little signs that Yahweh puts in the Bible for us to put together. So we know exactly who this person is in Daniel, that we clearly know that it's Yeshua. And it says, "And the living one, and the living one, and I became dead. Do not fear, I am the first and the last, and the living one. And I became dead, and behold, I am living forever and ever. And I have the keys of the grave and death." So again, he has the keys of the grave and death. 1 Corinthians 15. 1 Corinthians 15. That Yeshua has conquered death. And that is the greatest part of the New Testament. That not even death do we have to fear, because Yeshua was resurrected. He was dead and now he's alive forever. And what does that mean? That means even if we die, that we will be resurrected. Corinthians 15 and verse 51. "Behold, I speak a mystery to you. We shall not all fall asleep, but we shall be changed in a moment, in the blinking of an eye, at the last trumpet. For a trumpet will sound, and the dead will be raised incorruptible, and we will be changed. For this corruptible must put on incorruption, and this mortal must put on immortality. But when this corruptible shall put on incorruption, and this mortal shall put on immortality, then will take place the word that has been written, 'Death has been swallowed up in victory.' O death, where is your sting? Hades, where is your victory? Now the sting of death is sin, and the strength of sin is the Torah. But thanks be to Elohim, who gives us the victory through our Master Yeshua Messiah." Wow, praise Yahweh. That is the whole good news message lined up right there. And what does he say? He has the keys of the grave and death. The keys of the grave and death. So what is that telling us again? Probably at the end of the five keys or gateways to the kingdom. I'm probably going to do one message after that about what these keys do, because keys are very important, right? Keys represent authority. Keys represent authority. So he's saying he has the authority over death and over the grave.
Wow.
Praise Yahweh for that. Write what things you saw and what things are and what things are about to occur after these things. And that's what we're reading here. We're reading the very scroll that John wrote. And here it is for our day. We're reading this almost 2,000 years later. The mystery of the seven stars, which you saw on my right, and the seven golden menorahs. The seven stars are the messengers of the seven congregations, and the seven menorahs you saw are the seven congregations. We read that, and that ends chapter 1, and that is where we will stop today. So next week we are into now the seven congregations. I don't know how long it will take. Definitely we ain't going to get through it in a week or two, but it'll take several weeks, and we'll go through congregation by congregation and see what those messages are and try to get into deep to see, because like I said, at least one, maybe more of those messages are to each and every one of us. And we want to get that message, and we want to know what Yeshua is talking about. So while I pray that you appreciated this study, I am excited because Revelation is such an exciting Bible study. And just enjoy doing it. Enjoy having you be here in our home doing it also. So Yahweh bless. Shabbat Shalom. Have a great Shabbat. Until next week.